beginning of the college history, for half the college history, for the second revolution to come along, and then like Lothian buses, the revolutions come along all in a manner. And it says something about the way in which society is constantly moving and changing. It's an argument that we're actually going to, at this moment, through a seventh communications revolution, the digitization and information integration revolution. So there is this idea there of revolutions which shape and which change and which form our society, but it's as wrong to think of the technology as being everything as it is as wrong to think of human nature as simply not changing. If I get back to a Dutch tulip pulse for a minute, there's a really good illustration of that. Because, by the way, the reason why the Dutch tulip bulbs were all about futures was because nobody knew what the bulbs would actually produce when the flowers came. And that's very much the same idea as behind the complicated derivatives trading on the international markets and the slightly earlier and slightly more understandable dot-com boom and bust. But we all know how rapidly the dot-com bust was deflated. And we certainly know how rapidly in this world of 24-hour trading and automatic trading programs, the banking crisis and the stock market collapse came about. Interestingly, if you go back to 1637, people were still trading tulips at inflated prices in Amsterdam 2 days after the market had collapsed in Leiden, because the news hadn't yet got from Leiden to Amsterdam. So there's a complex, I think, interactivity between technology and society. And there's a societal context, both to what you do as technicians, technologists, and what we do as lawyers. And if you ignore the societal context, then we are writing in the sand. There is no doubt that the technology does change an important dynamic in society. You have, for example, although the jury is still out on just how influential social media was in it, but there is still the issue of, you know, was the Arab Spring at least facilitated by social media, modern communications, and there's a convincing case, prima facie case, that it was. There's a website in India called ipaidabribe.com. I mean, get it onto the net, you might want to look at it. Bribery is an endemic problem in Indian culture. And there's a mass movement, a grassroots movement, where people are just simply fed up of paying bribes. So you can post on the internet chat room, I paid a bribe, and tell the story. And the idea is to name and shame. And that is already having some kind of influence in changing deep-seated attitudes in Indian society. But you shouldn't necessarily think that, you know, there is this complicated interaction between society, technology, societal pressure. And it might be nice to think that in another context we're living in the end of history and everybody will live happily ever after. But of course, these things are not always positive. Those are a couple of positive examples I've given you. But it can equally be used for, well, we saw the use of social media, for example, in fomenting and helping spread the riots that we all unfortunately suffered, at least it did in England, earlier in the year. And you only need chat rooms entirely stuffed with paedophiles, say, to get a cut feedback where they self-legitimate each other, and what is to society unacceptable behaviour is reinforced in their minds as being entirely acceptable and indeed normal. Which brings me really to the core of the argument. Because what I think I wanted to try to do in just the introductory remarks is to set out that there is a social context. It isn't a black and white social context, and it's don't just think it's all easy, but equally, don't ignore the social context. I wanted to look in particular and illustrate that, and here's where I am going to actually start mentioning the word law a couple of times, by looking at the whole area of intellectual property and in particular copyright. There has always been in society, long before copyright was invented, a kind of social tension. Stuart Brand used to work at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he wrote a book, The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT. And in that book, he came up with this observation: information wants to be free. Information also wants to be expensive. Information wants to be free because it's become so cheap to distribute, copy, and recombine. Too cheap to meter. It wants to be expensive because it can be immeasurably valuable to the recipient. That tension will not go away. It leads to endless, wrenching debate about price, copyright, intellectual property, the moral rightness of casual distribution, because each round of new devices makes the tension worse, not better. I've secreted my water down here because I know from a lot of preaching on Sundays, that's something I do on my days off, to put the water up on the lectern with your notes is inviting disaster. And the notes, of course, relate to various aspects of good old Church of Scotland Christian morality. But there's an argument that the reason I'm not actually giving lessons about Woden and a Balder and all the pagan gods on Sundays is because of a bit of information tension. I think this is, you know, perhaps a stretching debate, but it's a nice, colourful way to express it. Once upon a time, there was a monastery in Ireland, and in that monastery there was an immensely valuable book, and the abbot did not want anybody copying the book. And if you attempted to copy the book, that was a punishable offence. Now, there was a particular monk who crept down at night and laboriously started copying the book. And this is an interesting illustration of Stuart Brown's tension, because copying, the technology for copying there is immensely difficult. Needs a huge effort of time and energy and sweat capital, as they say. And one day he was nearly done copying it when he was found out. And his punishment was that he was exiled beyond the monastery lands to the uttermost darkness, in fact, to the island of Iona. And of course, the monk in question was Columba. So, you know, fancifully, we're all Christians, or at least nominally so today, because of that particular bit of information and tension. But of course, as the technology improves, the more easy the more difficult the tension becomes, because the more easy it is to copy. Now, there's another thing which goes into the mix, and that is, you may or may not have heard of the Statute of Anne. It was an act passed by under Queen Anne just shortly after the Union of 1707 in 1710, and it laid down the modern law of copyright. It was the first anywhere in the world to do it. And it created this kind of Faustian bargain that we still live with today. That on the one hand, you want to reward the authors of works and encourage them to produce the works, but on the other hand, you recognize that there's a greater good in society by having free access to those works. And how do you balance the tension? And the trick of copyright is to balance that tension by creating a monopoly for a period, but the price for that monopoly is the passing into the public domain. Now, that's a principle that underlines all sorts of intellectual property. It underlines performers' rights, even patents. The price for getting a patent is you publish your method and it's readily available for anyone to copy once the monopoly period has come to an end. And I know some clients who just don't get patents because they'd rather try and just keep everything secret. Now, there's something more clever, though, about the Statute of Anne, because what it does is, in a very real sense, to commoditize ideas. It doesn't do that. You can't, any lawyer will tell you, make ideas property. So it does it by a medium of the expression of the idea is that which is protected. And of course, in patents, the particular way of doing something, the invention, is protected. There is nothing about this table which makes it property. It is a collection of wood, glue, nails, and bits of metal. What makes it property is that lawyers have surrounded it and fenced it with legal rights. I am no kind of Marxist, but Karl Marx did once say that the foundation of capitalism was when somebody took a bit of land and said, "This is mine." What actually happens to make this into property is that there's a whole legal structure which says that it's been paid for by the University of Edinburgh, it belongs to the University of Edinburgh, and if I were to be minded to wheel it out of the door, though that's a little unlikely since it took two people to get it into this position, I would actually be certainly committing a delict against the University of Edinburgh. They could sue me, and they could also, no doubt, bring the public prosecution service to bear because I'd be committing a crime. But why? There's nothing inherent in the table that makes it property. It's because there are legal rights with surrounding it. So we live and breathe this, and we don't think about it. We just accept it. But if you then look at the element of intellectual property, the great trick of Queen Anne was to say, okay, here's ideas, or you know, to be technically correct, the expression of ideas. And we are going to create a right to prevent copying in the author of the idea. We're going to create all manner of auxiliaries for a limited period. So essentially what Anne has done is to take the expression of these ideas, which are not inherently property, and make them property. It's commoditization. And that gives the real bite to the Stuart Brand quote, because of course the expression of ideas and becomes the first of the intellectual property. And that is bound to create further tension, because as soon as you have somebody saying, "This is my property," he wants to protect it. And where I'm leading to is a suggestion that both as technologists and lawyers, we have always got to ask ourselves, why is this so? Is this the best way of doing things? Does it exist in a vacuum? Or should we perhaps remember, as I said at the start, there's a broader societal context we have to take care of? That's a little bit of a trailer so as to keep you interested for later. But there is no doubt that with all of the wrenching debate about copyright term extension, ever more draconian remedies, you know, the Carter Report, Digital Britain, let's cut people's digital goodies off if they misbehave, or put it more accurately, limit their access to the internet if they get three strikes and you're out. What's that say about disenfranchisement of society? You know, there is always a thought. What we need is more regulation, stronger regulation, longer regulation, longer copyright terms. Statute of Anne was 7 years, extendable to 14. It's 17 now, I think, at last count. And then suddenly realised that Cliff Richard has been so long in the pop music business that his early recordings are about all to drop out of his performing right protection. So hey presto, the European Union has obligingly increased performers' rights protections to 70 years. And no doubt if Cliff Richards goes on to be a centenarian, we might find a further extension. You've got to ask, how effective is any of this? What does it actually say about the bargain, the Faustian bargain that I referred to when intellectual property was effectively invented? And let me give you a couple of quotes that sort of are for the let's give firm regulation lobby. There is the 7-year extension of copyright first came about in the United States as a result of something called the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Sonny Bono was a popular musician, as you know, the judge would say, who is Sonny Bono? But he had died, and his widow actually happened to be a congressman, or so was congresswoman, and had behind her the backing of the whole of the Hollywood entertainment industry, and chiefly their chief spokesman, Jack Valenti. And Congress, being, you know, terribly concerned to canvass all opinions, had congressional hearings on the extension of the copyright term. And this was way back in 1982. Jack Valenti argued in his written evidence before, on behalf of the Motion Picture Association of America, to the Congressional Committee, quote, "Creative property owners must be accorded the same rights and protection resident in all other property owners in the nation." Well, when the University of Edinburgh got title to this table, it keeps it when the table falls apart. And if I buy land, or they sell it, and if I buy land, the same applies in perpetuity of all my heirs inherited. And that was the thing about what should be happening to intellectual property, because after all, intellectual property is property, isn't it? Well, I'd argue intellectual property is property only because Queen Anne first had the idea of making it so. But there was also a problem with the United States, because Article 1, Paragraph 8 of the United States Constitution provides, "The Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries." Now note those words, "for limited times." So if you give people a perpetual copyright, that would actually, according to the United States Constitution, be unconstitutional. Aha, well, Mary Bono had the answer to that one. She said to Congress, "Actually, Sonny wanted the term of copyright protection to last forever. I'm informed by staff that such a change would violate the Constitution. I invite all of you to work with me to strengthen our copyright laws in all the ways available to us. As you know, there is also Jack Valenti's proposal for the term to last forever less one day." Perhaps the committee may look at that at the next Congress. Well, happily Congress wasn't that daft. But it is part of the thinking that lies behind it. And we're not insulated here in Europe or in the UK from what's happening in the United States, because there's a whole complex of the World Intellectual Property Organization, and perfectly reasonably, one seeks to coordinate regulation across the world because the world no longer knows boundaries. And if certain lobbies get to be too powerful, then they skew that Faustian bargain, and we're seeing it happen. Now, history, as Mark Twain says, doesn't repeat itself, but it does tend to rhyme. And, things I've been referring to, you know, I'm trying to give you a flavour of that. But there is a case, and it's here in Scotland, which is hugely important, I think, in the whole debate about copyright term extension and about strengthening of intellectual property rights beyond where they presently stand. And that is Hinton against Donaldson, Wood and Muros, which is decided in the Court of Session on the 28th of July, 1773. There's a very short report in the official law reports. It's no more than a paragraph, and it's frankly useless. But James Boswell, of Boswell and Johnson fame, actually appeared for a Donaldson, Wood and Muros, the defenders in that case. And it went before a court of 12 judges, all of whom gave a written opinion, and Boswell preserved that in a privately printed version, which is in the Advocates' Library. And if you want to actually get access to it, it's actually a facsimile of it is online, which you can get to by going to the, just Googling the International Free and Open Source Software Law Review, and look for articles which I've written, and you'll see a case law report on that with a hyperlink in the online version to the actual full and edited text of judgments. But the Lord Justice Clerk, I should explain, what had happened was that the booksellers in London had a monopoly on printed works. They had a monopoly printing in England. That had expired a few years before the Union and before Queen Anne's Act was enacted. There has never been such a monopoly in Scotland. And there was a nice little a publication which they were, and it was the Stationers' Company, which they were, was a Queen Mary in 1557 who gave them a monopoly, and they had a nice little publication out of which they were making quite a lot of money. It was a commentary on the Bible. I can't quite see that having the selling power nowadays. But it was, of course, out of copyright according to the statute of Anne. So they turned up before the English courts with a rather clever argument that, well, whatever the statute said, there's a common law right of copyright, perpetual copyright. You know, exists inherently in nature. It's a common law. And they were lucky in their judge because they actually got Lord Mansfield, who, before he became a judge, had been retained as standing counsel by the Stationers Association, company. So he found, yes, there was, and he pronounced an injunction. And then just as rather later in the whole business of footballers' wives, somebody dawned on them that, in fact, an English injunction doesn't apply in Scotland. So they rushed up to Scotland, and they sought to get an interdict in Scotland against the publication of the same work in Scotland. And for that, they argued that in the common law of Scotland, there is such a thing as a perpetual right of copyright. Well, what happens is that that argument resoundingly failed 11-1, and even the one who was in favour of it only said that he felt we ought to respect what was happening in England. And the substantive arguments were absolutely convincing. And if you read the arguments, every last one of them applies exactly today. There's the issue which the Lord Justice Clerk came up with. In short, upon examination, it will be found that there is no foundation for this copyright in authors in the common principles of law, and the only ground for it is this, that from the love of knowledge and the admiration of the works of learning and genius, mankind are prone to give authors not only the merit, but the reward that is due to them for their works. And upon this principle, every civilized state in modern times has introduced exclusive privileges to authors in the publication of their own works, some for a longer, some for a shorter time. But this suggests no idea of original property on the author, and it contrary, it's inconsistent with it. So explicit thing, this is just a matter of public policy. This is just the state according a limited monopoly to authors. But the judgment that is really resoundingly relevant today is that of Lord Kames. Now, those of you who studied philosophy will know that as well as being a judge, Lord Kames, this university originated from, was one of the great leading lights of the Scottish Enlightenment. So he approached it not only from the point of view but from the point of view of economics and the point of view of society. And each of those arguments appear. He felt that it was a privilege or a monopoly, it wasn't an inherent right, and if it were made an inherent right, it would, in perpetuity, it would counteract the designs of providence in making man a social and imitative being. It would be a miserable cramp upon improvements and prevent the general use of them. And then, he says, what of the art of printing? Now, I want you for a minute, as I read this about printing, to think about Microsoft and Windows, and the bundling of Windows, and the anti-competitive measures by which people get locked in to the operating system and to Windows. And as you think of that, just listen to this. What shall be said of the art of printing? If the monopoly of this useful art was to be perpetual, it would be a sad case for learned men and for the interest of learning in general. It would enhance the price of books far beyond the reach of ordinary readers. Such a monopoly would raise a fund sufficient to purchase a great kingdom. The works alone of Shakespeare or of Milton would be a vast estate. Well, the economic argument is there. Monopolies are bad. They raise prices. He looks at it from the point of view of the freedom of movement of goods. The commerce of movables ought to be free. And then he finally goes and looks at the economic case and the business case and finds it lacking. And he says, attend, on the other hand, to the consequences of a perpetual monopoly. It would unavoidably raise the price of good books. They'd be sold like so many valuable pictures. The sale would be confined to a few learned men and a mighty spare, and a few rich men who buy out of vanity as they buy a diamond or a fur coat. The commerce with books will be in a worse state than before printing was invented. And he looks very specifically about the problem of orphaned works, which is something which in your technological perspective you'll be looking at. So I would say to the people who believe that the future lies in ever lengthening copyright terms, ever more draconian measures, that be careful what they wish for, because there's a danger they might get it. But the end of the story, this is, having won in the Court of Session, the English case went on to a final appeal at the House of Lords, and happily, the House of Lords brought the English case into line with the Scottish one, and Robert Forbes, the Bishop of Ross and Caithness, recorded in his journal entry from 26th of February 1774 that when the news of Donaldson's victory in the House of Lords reached Scotland, it occasioned, and I quote, great rejoicings in Edinburgh upon victory over literary property. Bonfires and illuminations, ordered though by a not more, with a drum and two fifes. Well, I don't think I know any recent legal cases that have occasioned dancing in the streets, but that one did. Now, enough of perhaps law, but I thought it was useful to show that, you know, for the lawyers among us, these societal and economic and philosophical arguments are every bit as important as the precedent, and of course the Scottish case didn't follow the English precedent. But that is not the end of the matter by a long chalk. There's an unspoken assumption that if you have ever more draconian regulation and longer copyright terms, it'll actually work. Well, of course it won't. There are only two ways that you can impose law upon a society. One of the ways is with the consent of the governed, and the other way is with the overwhelming force of the tyrant. And the overwhelming force of the tyrant always breaks down. And the more the technology allows that tyrannical force to break down, the weaker the force becomes. And I mentioned the Arab Spring a while back. And the Scottish jurisprudence has always actually recognised this whole idea of the need for societal consent. There are not many old acts of the old pre-1707 Scottish Parliament still around, but there are a few. There are not many acts of the old English pre-1707 Parliament around, but there are rather more than a few. And the reason for the difference is that an English Act, the Old English Parliament, and indeed a present-day Westminster Act, remains on and an Act of the new Scottish Parliament, remains on the statute books till somebody gets round to repealing it. The Old Scottish Parliament had a concept known as desuetude. And what that meant was that if nobody was following the law, then it simply wasn't the law anymore. There is, on the English sense, technically still on the statute books of Scotland, an act preventing us from playing golf. Because of the great social evil is if we play golf, we can't attend to our archery practice. But of course, because of desuetude, it's just simply not the law of Scotland anymore. So, laws can only work, I believe, when they match the zeitgeist of the society. You cannot legislate by external constraints people into doing things which they do not find morally or socially acceptable. And you're a fool if you think you can. I'd like to actually think about this a little bit further. By looking at a particular case in point, which is the Swedish Pirate Party. Now, I don't know how many of you have actually heard of the Pirate Party. I'm sure a good lot of you will have done if you're in, gosh, surprisingly few, given that I've got a room full of techies in front of me.
Put your hands up in your
hand. Yeah. That will. It's okay, you're okay to have heard of the Swedish Pirate Party. Even the Church of Scotland has, because I did a report to the General Assembly which talked a great deal about the Swedish Pirate Party. Basically, the Swedish Pirate Party came into being as an offshoot of Pirate Bay. And Pirate Bay was, and still is indeed, an unlawful BitTorrent file sharing site. Now, there's a few figures I'll give you, and, yeah, here we are. You've got, I mean, file sharing is legal, end of story, unless you're doing it through a site. Now, I'm not going to hold it against you, you can mentally put your hands up. It would be nice if you did put your hands up. How many people use RapidShare, BitTorrent, Pirate Bay, any file sharing site? I see you. No, no, I'm not going to shock you. Just let's see. Your hands up. Go on. Hands up. Yeah, there you are.
Oh, kids. Put your hands up for your kids.
Yeah, exactly. And RapidShare is one of the biggest. It has several hundred million visitors every month across the world. Several hundred million visitors. Now, several hundred million people, there might be a few who are naturally criminally inclined and would mug an old lady over the head and take her purse, but I'm willing to bet you that almost all of them are perfectly happy to file share because they don't see anything morally wrong in it. The Pirate Bay had, in about 2008, which is where our story starts, something like 25 million peer users. And then the entertainment industry in Sweden decided it was time to make an example. Affair did, Kurajeles Ultra. So the directors of the Pirate Bay and the company itself were dragged off to court. And the whole proceedings ended on a £2,800,000 fine, and for each of the four principals of the Pirate Bay, a year in prison apiece. Now that'll deter them, won't it? Well, actually, before it started, the Pirate Party, which officially, because it would, well, like Mandy Rice Davis, it would say this, wouldn't it? Says it's of course got nothing to do with the Pirate Bay, had pretty decent number of members. In fact, they had 5,000 members. By the time the trial was over, they'd grown to 50,000 members. And on the day that the verdict was pronounced, they actually signed up 9,000 members. They've continued to grow. They are now, in terms of membership, the third largest political party in Sweden. They have the largest political youth organization in Sweden, and they have three members of the European Parliament who sit with the Greens. And incidentally, since we were talking of the Arab Spring, the Minister for Secretary of State for Youth and Sport in the new Tunisian government is a signed up member. You see, actually, I don't share the politics of the Pirate Party. They basically want copyright terms reduced to 5 years and the complete abolition of all patents. I think it's going far too far in the other direction. But to every action, there is, of course, an equal and opposite reaction. And the equal and opposite reaction has been, you know, to skew the balance in my submission, probably too far in the other direction. But as what I said, if you just get too draconian about trying to force people to do things which you don't want them to do, it won't work. It won't work technically. I mean, the only reason the Pirate Bay were taken to court was because they couldn't physically block the access. So let's bring the lawyers in, and the lawyers will make an example of them, won't they? Of course, that didn't work. Totally counterproductive. And you've got the same issue, I think, in every area of regulation. And I think we've got to be smarter about how we regulate. Lord Carter did a report on digital brevet, and there's a more recent one which has come out, which is the Hargreaves report, which I think has got the balance a lot better. Mm-hmm. But the Carter report was this one, all as I was saying about the three strikes and you're out, it's now the, I forget what we called the act that was enacted. But in any event, I did actually once tackle Lord Carter just after he'd revealed his report and pointed out to him that one way to get the law actually operative was to just make sure that people did have some kind of respect for it. And the one way that he could do it is, our hands are somewhat tied by the European Copyright Directive. You know, European directives do tie our hands and we have to follow them. But there are states within the European Union which allow the taking of a single copy for personal use, in other words, format shifting. And that's totally innocuous activity. You know, you've got your old CD and you put it onto your MP3 player or something like that. Well, actually, in the United Kingdom, that is unlawful. You're breaching copyright, you're not allowed to do it. Perfectly legal in France. So I suggested, you know, we can just decriminalise a whole area, get some kind of respect for the law if people were allowed to format shift as a fair use. And he muttered something about having his hands tied by Europe, which and he said I was the first person to ask him and raise the issue. Well, of course, hands are not tied by Europe because the Copyright Directive has that in as an optional power which member states can choose to exercise or not. And Hargreaves, in his report, happily has picked that point up, and we might be looking for law change soon. So where, then, does this all get us? Because I want to leave a little bit of time for questions. And it gets me to the title of this lecture, which is Canute and the Waves. You know the story. King Canute was sat down on his throne as the tide came in, because he was all-powerful, and he forbade the tide to come in, as it lapped his feet, and then got up to his knees, and then got up to a certain personal parts. Now, there was a big difference between Canute and the copyright absolutists, because Canute actually knew what he was doing. He'd had all these yes men surrounding him, telling him how great he was and how wonderful he was. And he wanted to prove to them that he wasn't. And that's why he sat and forbade the waves to come in. The trouble is that the world is full of people, largely in the entertainment industry, who are like Canute, but they don't know what they're doing. Beware, you know, they might get what they're after. Legislators follow the money. They have I'm not suggesting bribery for a moment, but they have, and I'm really not, but they have very, very, very well-funded lobbying organizations who can make all this sound terribly, terribly plausible. And anybody who wants to say, well, the balance has got to be redressed, I don't think can be like the Pirate Party. I don't think can say just abolish the whole lot, because there is a reason why Queen Anne had, or her ministers had, the clever idea of essentially commoditizing ideas. It does unleash a huge spurt of creativity towards artists, but you've got to get the balance right. And where I think that we as lawyers, you as technologists, and indeed society as a whole, has got to come in is we have a problem. You know, if you're not going to be, if you're acknowledging the present model of intellectual property protection is broken, is not likely to get fixed, is just, in some Brown's words, going to get worse, then you've got to think of other and cleverer means. It's easier to talk about the long tail and making money out of concerts, etc., etc. And there's economic research which suggests that that actually gives a very, very small advantage disproportionately to really famous artists, and anyone who's struggling just doesn't see anything out of it. You know, there's a need to be creative and to think, but at the very least, we need to start realizing that the technology you develop, the laws that legislators make, the laws that lawyers apply, and where we have some room, you know, areas of common law, the changes that we argue for, all exist in a societal context. Human nature doesn't change. We still rush in there after our tulip bulbs. We still want to copy the valuable missal in the monastery library. But what does change because of the technology is this incredible tension and balance between the two opposite poles, information which wants to be free and information which simultaneously wishes to be immensely valuable. And as all of the best lectures do, I am going to, well, all lectures end, but as the best lectures do, I'm not actually going to give you any answers. I'm just going to say that that is the challenge. And if you don't think about the challenge, whichever area of interest you come from, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a technologist, or just a member of society, whether you're a legislator, whether you're in industry, whether you're in business, if you just don't take into account that challenge and that societal context, the whole zeitgeist of society, and you're walking blindfold into the future. Thanks.
Thanks very much indeed. We have time for a few questions. Do we have any questions for you, please? Jeff.
I've been a bit shocked recently by the extent of the increase in coverage of things that are being protected by intellectual property law. One thing that profoundly shocked me that I learned the other day was that for a long time, the biggest money-making patent that AT&T had was that they placed a patent on the idea of transferring incoming calls to 800 numbers to other numbers. They had a table of 800 numbers that had been allocated to people, and as the calls came in, a computer program looked up the number in the table and routed it to the right proper
number. Can I ask you, was that an American patent?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so.
The Americans seem to be patenting things where it's absolutely absurd to patent them, just routine business practices like one-click shopping.
There's a whole course of lectures on that, which I'm going to deliver tonight, but there's a short answer. The short answer is that Americans have a fundamentally different attitude towards patenting. Within the European Union, you cannot patent software as such. And